Great, thank you very much. And a good moment to really thank Anna Shukilo properly for the quality of this evening's visual presentation. It occurs to me that actually we could equally have divided the evening into Holzer and John Walker looking at different ways to deal with forms, be it bingo cards or redacted torture notes. And then part two could have been Peter Fend and David Hockney, two different ways to think about technology and the environment and ecology. So it's interesting how, you know, one can mix it up in less obvious, less causal, kind of less generational and mediumistic kind of ways. So David Hockney, like Holzer, being considered for the second time on the review panel. It's a sign some people think of dotage when you start repeating yourself. So as we turn 10, the review panel looks at artists for the second time. So David Hockney. Who's going to kick me off on David Hockney? What do we make of... Would Peter Fend learn something from David Hockney about the environment? That's the question I want to ask the panel. Who would like to say to me for the first, who would like to be the first to say to me, I'm going to ignore that question and say something else?
I'll take the bait.
Yes?
I went into the Hockney exhibition and I found myself like really mesmerized by this video where he's driving down this road and everything is fragmented into this nine square grid. And I found that really the most compelling work in the exhibition because I felt that the technology was used to reflect to me something about the nature of my own vision and my own experience when I'm in, like, moving through a landscape. The drawings that were covering the entrance part raised a question for me about the relationship between looking at a landscape as an individual with your very specific body of knowledge and the things that your eye grasps on one particular day or another, as opposed to the notion of scanning, which, you know, to go back to our technology theme, is sort of a more blanket recording, more democratic of all the events that are in front of you. And also with the second body of work, the iPad drawings, I found myself really looking at the generalization of form that was taking place through the iPad drawings. And for me, both of those raised critical issues.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Can I ask, Marjorie, I know you're bursting with many things to say about Hockney, but can I ask, let's do a comparison of Hockney's nine-panel moving grid of that road in Yorkshire and Fenn's ocean coming towards us. That seems to be between a very, as we say, conceptual and pastoral show, as Fend and Hockney are, that would seem to be you could imagine those two pieces in one show with a common theme, couldn't you?
I'm going to change the topic. I've learned from my politicians.
Do it more subtly, with respect.
I know. What they do is they ignore the question and pretend that they've answered it. So I'm at least being more transparent.
I would be so flattered if you pretended. But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. There's a book on Hockney, the title of which is Hockney's Pictures. The key term for Hockney's work is pictures, not paintings. In the history of British illustration, in which Hockney, no matter which way he turns, is embedded, the term depiction, picturing, description that relies on prosthesis, as in the camera, is where I place the show, and that there is nothing in the show, despite the mild fauvist gestures, that changed my view that the key term is really picture, not painting.
Right. Picture, not painting, sign, not symbol, objective, not subjective. Ken, would you agree? I do, but after Ken's comes in first. Dichotomies here between picture and painting. Do you find such a dichotomy useful in making sense and coming to terms with Hockney?
I mean, there's an introduction to the show where he talks about having suffered a mild stroke. He's deaf. He's, how old is he? 80 something? 77? Oh, 77? I thought he was older. So I thought there was this, I felt this kind of elegiac feeling about all the roads are in the prints are going into the forest and sort of disappearing into a burst of color or light and the endless road. So I read it kind of in symbolist terms and it seemed poignant to me in that respect. So I felt, you know, I've always liked Hockney's relationship. I mean, he's such a facile. He's so skilled as an illustrator, and I initially I breezed through the show and thought that the larger works were actually paintings, and then so I was very impressed when I came back and realized they were made on an iPad. I found them kind of beautiful, but I thought these don't feel particularly relevant to me at this point in time, to anything I'm 61 myself and probably becoming increasingly irrelevant, but I don't feel in these four artists that there's the center of gravity of energy in contemporary art now is that's where it's at, that there's a kind of settled occupation of paths that started 30, 40, 50 years ago. What do you think, Marjorie?
The last sentence was interesting, that you don't feel the relevance. That can be developed quite interestingly in terms of something I was taught to think with. That is to say, there are some artists who are original and produce paradigms, and others produce the definitive versions of those. I don't know that any of the four artists would qualify for either, but what the model here is that sometimes what you would consider settled could also be a kind of loyalty to a certain set of forms or contents that the artist abides by, is dedicated to, whether or not he or she is on the radar of the media, certainly. And so, and I'm not saying the shows, I'm not defending any one show relative to that. I'm just offering that model. Bach would, the composer Bach would fall into something. The second of those models, his sons thought he was so old-fashioned, but it's Bach we remember.
I think that's really interesting to look at an artist's work in terms of how the original conceit of the work pans out over the entire career. Like, how does that idea or what they're doing develop over a long period of time? And I think with Hockney, you see that it ends up, for me, in a kind of banality there at the end, where there's certainly been really interesting moments, and probably every student's been influenced by his Emperor on the River video in terms of the sort of dynamics of looking at different perspectival systems. But you know, I think we get to the end and we see that show, it's very hard to, I mean, it, to me it's very hard to critique because of what Ken said at the beginning. You come in and you read the statement and you just feel like you can't really critique this show because...
I think there's tons here that we can critique. And I would remind the panel that the software that he's using on his iPad is entirely predicated on painting. It is an attempt, it gives one the power with one's fingers, so it goes from the digit to the hand and the arm, but one is slowing down, so it's kind of a bit more like printmaking. But basically, the technology is all geared around giving you access to shapes and colors to then put onto a backlit environment in order to, and then to correspond in any way your imagination or your facility take you to your response to that other environment, the place where you are, the landscape you're looking at, so on and so forth. So I'd say they're very traditional, you know, but paint, the whole history of art is finding new technologies. I mean, tubes of paint was as big and as radical a technological innovation in the 19th century as the iPad is in the 21st. I think that the dichotomies that Marjorie is pulling forward between pictures and paintings, which is something that I've long been fascinated with, are much more instructive than worrying too much about whether they're iPads or whether they're paintings.
Yeah, but I think Hockney got led astray by, I mean, he's so easily seduced by new gadgets. You know, to me, his best work is the realist period of the 70s when he made those big, large double portraits.
Right.
I mean,
okay.
I love the way they're painted, and there's this sort of psychological tension between the characters, and that whole period.
Mr. and Mrs. Clark.
Yeah. Or Henry Geldzahler and his friend, you know, there's in the or the picture of the guy looking into the pool. I mean, they're really rich pictures.
But we can all have our own Hockney moment. I love the paintings of the very early paintings he was doing in the sort of Dubuffet style with those sort of first gay images and those sort of British pop sort of Typhoo Tea things.
But what I'm saying is that, I mean, sometimes your criteria is, for me, like, look what the artist did at his or her best. And I don't know if that's fair or not, but I do that. And I think, you know, what if Hockney was still working in that sort of really, very acutely attentive way with regard to not just visual experience, but social experience.
Yeah, but Ken, what if Hockney at his very worst was still better than Holzer and Walker and Fend? Then we'd be a strange kind of evaluation system. It'd be like the Olympics saying the person who came first is going to get the bronze because he could have gone faster. I mean, that would be weird, wouldn't it? I mean, not that I'm saying it is a race. But let's get back to the stuff. Let's get back to the Joan. Marjorie. Picture versus, I try to map a few other dichotomies onto your dichotomy of picture and painting, and then I took it over to Ken. So I take it back to you. Does the subjective versus the objective, does that work with picture-painting dichotomy as well?
Picking up on, to answer your question, I'll pick up on something Ken said. In addition to Hockney's, actually, avidity for British illustration, I think his gift is something he ignored. I'm not talking about the facility with which he is dazzled. I'm talking about the gift by which, the swimming pool paintings, at least some of them, and the coincidence of the then new technology called acrylic paint, he produced a kind of Shangri-La of affectlessness, of a California permanent happiness. I think that inflection of a world of innocence will be his contribution. And I keep wondering, why didn't he notice this as his particular way of bringing the cult of the child, with which he should be familiar through Runge, for instance, and the Pre-Raphaelites in their own morbid pieties, but a kind of innocence within that. You would think he would be more cognizant. I don't consider him a cognizant artist for all his technical wherewithal.
That's very, very interesting, because really, if he had just continued in a vein that was a success for him and with his public, he would have become formulaic, and he's somebody who's got a very restless visual mind and intellectual mind, and that restlessness with new ideas is, to my mind, the perfect embodiment of childishness. I mean, it seems to me that actually his use of the iPad is, he's like a kid with a new toy. And that, what could be more childish than a kid with a toy?
So, I didn't say childish, but it's not childlike. About
childlike.
It's not really about being childlike, but I think what Marjorie was saying is that in those paintings that were childlike, he's giving us a kind of reflection on the social condition of California in a way that allows us to gain a new perspective. And when I see the paintings that are in the Pace, I don't feel that sense of perspective. I don't feel that sense of being engaged in any kind of awareness of the social body and allowing his own art to be a reflection of that perspective. And I feel like that's what I'm missing when I go into the Hockney show. Like, he's secluded himself and he's been fascinated by these toys, you know, and it kind of reminds you of the millions of people walking down the street, you know, they're standing in front of somewhere and they're looking for it on their phone.
More specifically with regard to the show, like the charcoal, there's two things. There's charcoal drawings, which are made by hand and drawn not from photographs but on site, which I thought were okay, just as drawings. I mean, 77 isn't the age where you say, oh, that's pretty good for an old guy. That's like, you can still, you know, when you get to be 95, say, you could say, oh, that's pretty good. But they're not that good.
It's hard to hold them up to Matisse's late work.
Or Titian. I mean, so are you saying...
I mean, even, you know, not even measuring against the great old masters. They're just not that interesting drawings. They're flat and they're sort of, you know, they're sort of facile. But the prints, I mean, David, you want to make a case for drawing on the iPad as being a form of painting. But I think you could do anything. Anybody could just make marks on that thing, a dog, and you could send it to the printers who print them, and the thing would be beautiful just because the colors and the technology itself is inevitably visually dazzling.
In the 1950s, a monkey named Congo was trained by Desmond Morris to paint. But that was then to people who didn't get abstract expressionism, they said, oh, this is as good as abstract expressionism. But that really just tells us about the Philistinism of those people, not about the monkey.
That's not about that. So, David, you're not getting my point.
Oh, well, repeat it.
The point is that if you take materials that are inherently beautiful.
But an iPad's not inherently beautiful. It's kind of banal and ugly most of the time. But I mean,
the colors that am I wrong? I don't know. I don't have an iPad.
It's very seductive. I get your point, Ken. It's very seductive, and you could put anything there, and it would be very seductive, and you could look at it. But there's something missing.
And you get them printed in beautiful inks, and you know,
it looks great.
Right. So, paint isn't like that. I mean, if a monkey paints a painting, it looks like a monkey made it, or an elephant, but. And paint is like mud. Paint. In order to make paint look beautiful, you have to like do a lot of stuff to it, unless you already have in place an aesthetic that values ugliness or certain kind of schnabel like.
I would actually suggest that the iPad prints are a failure because I want to see them on an iPad. They need to be backlit. and they need to be the scale at which he manipulated them in the first place. So I will be more excited to see those images, as he has actually in the past, presented on iPads. I mean, it seems once you're paying the price of a Hockney, it's hardly, Pace would hardly be that generous to also throw in an iPad as well on top. So why don't they just give us iPads?
That's sort of like with Jeff Wall. I mean, like Jeff Wall's, nothing yeah. Jeff Wall did is as interesting as the giant transparencies on light boxes.
Right.
So, but again, that goes to...
Ladies and gentlemen, let's move to...